Good morning. It's amazing when you start to prepare these lessons on the Decalogue. It seems like, well, there are just 10 commandments. You should be able to cover that in about the first half of the first lesson on the Decalogue. Then you realize there's virtually an infinite number of ways and directions that you can go, which really just speaks to the infinite nature of the Word of God, which, of course, is His revelation of His own character and self and mind to us. My intent today is to finish the Ten Commandments. We only have six to go, but, well, we'll see how that works out. When we discussed the structure of the Decalogue some number of weeks ago, I pointed out that Commandments 1, 2, and 3 pertain to Israel's relationship with Yahweh. They define, if you will, the vertical connection between Israel and God. Israel's to avoid idolatry at all costs, and Israel's to honor God's holy name, holding it in high regard since obviously it represents the person of God Himself. Commandments 5 through 10 pertain to the horizontal connection, that is, relationships that exist between men on the human plane. These commandments pertain to affiliations that Israel's to enjoy with her covenant brothers and also, to some degree at least, with the nations that surround them, their neighboring nations. The purpose of these last few commandments is to bring about social structure that provides order for the people on a day-to-day basis, and this is what we're going to try to look at today. In between the first three and the last five commandments is commandment number 4, the commandment to observe a special day called the Sabbath. I believe that commandment is somewhat transitional. It links Israel's relationship to our God and the relationships that we'll talk about today between brother and brother and Israel and her neighbors back to the creation. You might ask, why in the world would the creation play a role in the formation of the Mosaic Law? And I think, first of all, it's to link us back to the story of creation in Genesis chapter 2. When we contemplate God as the Creator, we're acknowledging that He's transcendent, that is, that He is greater than the creation itself. And this knowledge guides us away from man's innate tendency to worship the creation rather than the Creator. The link between the Sabbath and the creation asks us to consider the role of ceasing from rest, or ceasing from work. The rest that we speak of in the creation story that leads us to the Sabbath, the day of rest, is really a picture of our salvation. When God ceased from His work, He stopped doing the work because it was completed, and He then entered into a state of rest. And I pointed out to you last week that the Hebrew word that's used in the Genesis 2 account for rest and the Hebrew word that's used in the citation of that verse in Exodus 20 are two different words. One, the word that's used in Genesis refers to the actual cessation of work. The word that's used in the citation in Exodus refers to the state of rest that results from ceasing from work. The Exodus term has more a sense not of stopping something, but of settling down and remaining in a certain state. Another reason that the Sabbath commandment is transition commandment and is linked back to creation is to illustrate that when Israel enters the promised land, they'll do so as a people who are, in fact, a new creation. When they come into the promised land, old things will have passed away and all things will have become new. So for the fourth time today, I think we'll begin our actual exegesis of the text by reading the Decalogue. You should have this memorized soon. Exodus chapter 20, verse 1. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, or any likeness that is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I am Yahweh your God, and I'm a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God, and in it you shall not do work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or female servant or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that's in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Thus ends the Decalogue, what we call the Ten Commandments. Commandment number 5, which is our starting point today, is found in verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which I'm giving to you. This commandment is quoted in the New Testament in Ephesians 6:2 as the first commandment with a promise. The promise that you will remain and your time in the land will be prolonged is a promise that was made specifically to Israel, and it has to do with their remaining in peace in the land of Canaan. This is not a universal promise that if you treat your parents nicely, you'll live a long life. And it's certainly not something that can be reversed to presume that if a person dies young, it was because he dishonored his parents. This is a promise that's specific to Israel in the land of Canaan. Nevertheless, the Torah, when you get into the Mosaic Law and you read how the Torah views this, it exacts a very severe penalty to a child who's unwilling to accept the discipline of the father. If you'll listen to what the Torah says over in Deuteronomy chapter 21, beginning with verse 18, this is how seriously God takes that commandment. If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother when they chastise or discipline him, when he will not listen to them, then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of his hometown. And they shall say to the elders of the city, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He's a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove this evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear of it and fear. I would think that probably got the attention of sons and daughters in this particular time. It was a capital offense for a child to disobey or dishonor the parents. If you think about that in the context of the parable of the prodigal son, it brings to light how serious that incident was and how deeply the father's forgiveness of the son goes. Israel is to observe the Sabbath day because the Sabbath represents Israel's new relationship with the Lord as a chosen nation. But she's to honor the father and mother because, like the Sabbath, the father and the mother are, in a sense, partners in creation of the life that is ordered to bring honor to them. They share that trait with God. God established the Sabbath and the creation. The parents are involved in the creation of the life of the son or the daughter. So children are to honor their parents in the same way that all Israelites were to honor the Creator. After all, if you think about it, God has decreed that Israel is his firstborn son. So all of these metaphors and analogies link together. The key term in the fifth commandment is this word I've written up here, kavev. It's translated honor. But if you look at the word in detail, it really means to be heavy. That's the primary meaning of the word kavev. But when it's written as it is in this particular text, it means to bring honor or to bestow honor. You can think of it like this. Think of a person who is heavy with gold and silver. A person who is heavy with gold and silver would garnish a lot of attention and would, in a sense, be a heavyweight in the community. Heavyweight is not that far removed from what kaveh means. So when a child is to deal with the parent, it's to be done in honor, and he is to attribute a great deal of weight to that relationship that he has with his parents. It means to recognize the value of the parent and to treat them as something of value. The esteem that this commandment requires of the children to the parent, it's well understood because the parents stand as the head of one of the divine institutions. The parents have the God-given authority in the family. In a covenant community like Israel, the parents mediate the covenant stipulations. They mediate the law to the children, and they impart not only to them their physical life, but they also impart spiritual life to the children through the teaching and mediation of the law. In addition to that, the parents really fall into a class we might call as the class of fellow man. That is, the relationship between a father and a son is a human relationship. In the commandment to honor the parents, we begin to see the duty that the Israelite, and in our case the believer, has to others on this horizontal plane as he seeks to deal with his fellow man. There probably are a few limitations to the fifth commandment. If you look at the Old Testament and then the New Testament, you'll see that they recognize a slightly different social order. In the Old Testament, children were under the authority of the father as long as the father was alive. You can look at Genesis chapter 42 and 43 and see examples of this. Once you get to the New Testament, it doesn't quite seem like that tradition follows through, although it's reasonable to assume in the New Testament that children fell under the authority of the parents at least as long as they lived under their roof. I can remember using that example with my own children as reasons that they needed to do what I told them to do. And I'm not assuming here that the slightest failure on the part of a parent is a good reason for rebellion. But the parents here, I think, in this commandment are assumed to be living under the covenant. It is assumed when we talk about children obeying and honor the parent that the parent is not leading the child into some sin or way of life that is contrary to the covenant. And I think that there is a line in the sand there that would be difficult to explain, but it's probably one of those things you'd need to be there to know. Commandment number 6 is, thou shalt not kill. And I've quoted it that way because that's the well-known way it's quoted from the King James translation, and we're all familiar with that wording. But probably of all the commandments, this is the one that raises a lot of questions. What does it mean, thou shalt not kill? How does the sixth commandment relate to issues such as capital punishment? Or abortion, war, killing someone in an act of self-defense, either defense of your own life or defense of someone else. Well, the commandment itself, thou shalt not kill, rests on a theological statement that we find back in Genesis chapter 9. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God he made man. The value of human life rests in God's image, which God put into man at the creation, and which man continues to bear even after the fall. Of the next three commandments, which are, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, killing, adultery, and theft, this sixth commandment is the one that garners most of the attention for several reasons. First of all, the consequences of breaking the sixth commandment are irreversible. Stolen goods can be returned. Marriages can be healed. A life that's taken can never be given back again. As serious as violating any commandment is, the consequences of taking a life are absolutely the most serious, not only for the victim, but for the one breaking the commandment and the families of everyone who's concerned. Another consideration is this. It's unlikely the government is going to draft you into a form of service and demand that you commit adultery. It's probably not going to happen. You may be able to avoid that one. It's also unlikely that you'll be drafted and asked to steal or rob from someone in your community. That's probably not going to happen. But it's not out of the question. You may be called into a situation where you're required to, in an environment where you may have to kill somebody. Or if not, you may have to sit on a jury that's deciding a capital case where the life of the victim rests on the decision that you make. So having a clear understanding of what this commandment means is really important. I'm going to do something a little out of the ordinary. I found an article. This is where we might not make it through the whole thing. This depends on you more than me. I found an article that was published on January 25th in the Washington Post. It's written by a man named Timothy Kudo, K-U-D-O, and I want to read it to you. It's pretty short. Marine Captain Timothy Kudo, a graduate student at New York University, deployed to Iraq in 2009 and to Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011. Here's what he said. When I joined the Marine Corps, I knew I would kill people. I was trained to do it. I was trained to do it in a number of ways, from pulling a trigger to ordering a bomb strike to beating someone to death with a rock. As I got closer to deploying to war in 2009, my lethal abilities were refined. My ethical understanding of killing was not. I held two seemingly contradictory beliefs. Killing is always wrong, but in war, it's necessary. How could something be both immoral and necessary? I didn't have time to resolve this question before deploying. And in the first few months, I fell right into the role of killing without thinking twice. We were simply too busy to worry about the morality of what we were doing. But one day in Afghanistan in 2010, my patrol got into a firefight and we ended up killing two people on a motorcycle. We thought they were about to attack us. They ignored or didn't understand our warnings to stop, and according to the military's escalation of force guidelines, we were authorized to shoot them in self-defense. Although we thought they were armed, they turned out to be civilians. One looked no older than 16. It's been more than 2 years since we killed those people on the motorcycle, and I think about them every day. Sometimes it's when I'm reading the news or watching a movie, but most often it's when I'm taking a shower or walking down my street in Brooklyn. They're not the only deaths I carry with me. I also remember the first time a Marine several miles away asked me over the radio whether his unit could kill someone who was bearing a bomb. The decision fell on me alone. I said yes. Those decisions became commonplace over my deployment. Even more frightening than the idea of what we were doing was how easy it became for me. I never shot someone, but I ordered bomb strikes and directed other people to shoot. Many veterans were unable to reconcile such actions in war with the biblical commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." When they come home from an environment where killing is not only accepted but is a metric of success, the transition to one where killing is wrong can be incomprehensible. This incongruity can have devastating effects. After more than 10 years of war, the military lost more active service members last year to suicide than to enemy fire. More worrisome, the Department of Veterans Affairs estimates that 1 in 5 Americans who commit suicide is a veteran. That'd be 20%, despite the fact that veterans make up just 13% of the population. While I don't know why individual veterans resort to suicide, I can say that the ethical damage of war may be worse than the physical injuries we sustain. To properly wage war, you have to recalibrate your moral compass. It's an interesting statement. Once you return from the battlefield, it's difficult or impossible to repair it. VA started referring to this problem as moral injury, but that's a deceptive euphemism as collateral damage. This isn't the kind of injury you recover from with rest, physical therapy, or pain medication. War makes us killers. We must confront this horror directly if we're to be honest about the true costs of war. I didn't return from Afghanistan as the same person. My personality is the same, or at least close enough, but I'm no longer that good person I once thought I was. There's nothing that can change that. It's impossible to forget what happened, and the only people who can forgive me are dead. I'll never know whether my actions in Afghanistan were right or wrong. On good days, I believe they were necessary. But instead, I want to believe that killing, even in war, is wrong. America will participate in other wars in my lifetime, but if the decision to do so is collective, then civilians need to have a better understanding of the consequences. The immorality of war is not a wound we can ignore, and it is painfully obvious why so many veterans are committing suicide. Basically, then, the article goes on with some closing statements. I read this article not because I want to put the VA on trial here. That's not the point. I read the article because I want us to understand what were the presuppositions this young man took with him to Afghanistan. One was killing is always wrong. That was a presupposition. That is a belief system that he held based on his understanding of the commandment, thou shalt not kill. And his other presupposition was, nevertheless, in war it's necessary. And his moral dilemma he expresses in the question, how could something be both immoral and necessary? So I want you to understand, I'm not being critical of the military. There's no one here who's more pro-military than I am. And I'm certainly not being critical of this young man, but I want you to understand that in the world today, there is a real dilemma between what people think they know, what the Bible actually teaches, and the results and effects that having a misunderstanding of the biblical principles and going into these situations with the wrong set of presuppositions, how they can absolutely turn your life upside down. So this is a young man who's been, at least to some degree, steeped in the knowledge of this commandment, thou shalt not kill. As a result of that, he has in his mind a presupposition, killing is always wrong. He also understands that it is sometimes necessary in war, and it results in a moral dilemma. How can something be immoral and necessary in a world where God is sovereign? That's essentially what we take from the article. To understand the commandment, which is really one of the sources of this guy's confusion, you have to understand this word. It's the word ratzach. And I don't know if you can see it, this H has a dot under it. That means it's got a little bit of a guttural sound at the end. This is the term that's used in the sixth commandment, thou shalt not ratzach, thou shalt not kill. There are seven or eight Hebrew terms that mean kill. And they all have different nuances and different shades of meaning. Our particular word is interesting. It's a pure Hebrew word. It has no parallels in any other Semitic languages. That means that we can't go to some of the other Semitic languages and find in them precedents for understanding what this word means. The other difficulty is the first time this word appears in the Old Testament is in this commandment. And one of the things you do when you're trying to understand what a word means is you go to its first occurrence. Well, in this case, the first occurrence in the Old Testament is the place where we're trying to understand the meaning of the word. So we lose that particular ability to research as well. Ratzach occurs 46 times in the Old Testament. Of those 46 occurrences, 20 of them occur in Numbers chapter 35, which, by the way, is an extremely instructive chapter to read in terms of understanding what the commandment, thou shalt not kill, means. If you look at the broad semantic range, if you will, the range of meaning of this particular word, and I'm going to go to Numbers chapter 35, look at verse 11. Chapter 35 of Numbers is about the establishing of cities of refuge, places where someone who has killed someone can go and be safe. So what we're doing here is we're trying to understand the meaning of this word ratzach. So let's look at verse 11. You shall select for yourselves cities to be cities of refuge, that the manslayer, I'm reading from the NASB. Does anyone else's text say anything other than manslayer? Person who kills someone. Okay, so let's think about this. That the manslayer, that's the word rutsak, it's a participle, rotsake, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there. So, one of the meanings of rutsak is what we call manslaughter, the unintentional killing of another human being. So we see immediately we can't limit the meaning of rutsak to premeditated murder, can we? Because it's used here in chapter 35 of Numbers to refer to manslaughter. It's used in verses 27 and 30 of revenge killings. That's the whole purpose of the city of refuge. So if you accidentally killed, for example, a family member of your neighbor, it would be natural for your neighbor to want to exact retribution against you by killing you. But you could go to the refuge city, and your neighbor could not follow you there and do anything to you. In 2 Kings 6, verse 32, it's used of assassinations. In Job chapter 24, rutsak is used to refer to a killing that occurs in the act of committing a felony. In Psalm 94:6, it refers to the slaying of orphans and widows as an act of cruelty. And then let's look at verse 20. This is an important one to read. If this refers to the person doing the killing, that's who he refers to. If he pushed him, the victim, out of hatred, or threw something at him lying in wait, and as a result, he died, and it goes on and refers to him then as rotsak, as a murderer. So here we would have certainly a killing that occurs as a result of hatred, and it certainly would include premeditated murder. Let's try to summarize contextually what these terms mean in these different passages. I think the best summation I can give you of the use of this word is this: do not take an innocent life. Do not take an innocent life. The emphasis, if you trace all of these 46 occurrences in the Old Testament, the emphasis on will predominantly be on the victim, not on the person doing the killing. So the focus is on the innocence of the victim. Certainly in a manslaughter situation, if you accidentally kill somebody, it was an accident. It wasn't motivated by hate or premeditation. So the emphasis there is on the innocence of the victim. It's important to understand what this word means because I think it will prevent a lot of the seeming inconsistencies between the prohibition against killing, as would be indicated in the King James translation, and things that God has in fact sanctioned, things such as capital punishment and taking a life in the prosecution of a war. I know there are people who would like to make this more clear-cut and say rutsak only refers to premeditated murder. Well, that's certainly one of the things it means, but if you look at these other contextual occurrences, you're going to see that it means more than that. That's not the complete meaning of the word. We know that God values human life because man carries the image of God from creation. So there obviously are times where killing is absolutely wrong, but there are times when it's not. I think what we can say for sure is that Tim Kudo's proposition that killing is always wrong is wrong. It doesn't match what the word means that's used in the commandment. Sometimes, in fact, it's the right thing, and sometimes it is, in fact, ordained by God, such as in capital punishment. And if you look back at Genesis 9:6, there we read, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man's blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man." If you are wondering about the New Testament, if you look over to Romans chapter 13, which is the chapter that's on submission to human government, and consider the first four verses, it says, "Every person is to be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those which exist," that is governments, "exist and are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. You want to have no fear of authority? Do what's good, and you'll have praise from the same. For it, human government, is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it, human government, does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. This term's emphasis on not killing the innocent, even in these situations that are ordained. As a society, we have to make sure we get it right if you're going to impose the ultimate punishment. The Bible also acknowledges killing in self-defense. This is a situation any person could find himself in. Nearly every week, I get an email that someone has broken into a house in my neighborhood in the middle of the night. A couple of times, people have been tied up. It could happen. Let's look at the 22nd chapter of Exodus, just a couple of pages over, beginning with verse 2. If a thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. If you look at the Texas state law on use of lethal force, it draws distinctions between lethal force used in the night, in the dark, and lethal force used in the day, and the proof of a threat to your life in the day is much higher than it is at night. Exodus 22 says you have the right to defend yourself. It says you have the right to use lethal force to defend yourself and your family. And if you do so, that's a form of killing. But it's not posed by the commandment. Ecclesiastes is pretty clear. Verse 3 of chapter 3, it says there's a time to kill and a time to heal. Verse 8 says there's a time for war and there's a time for peace. And as we saw, Romans 13, verse 4 indicates that the government is authorized to use the sword. I would interpret that to mean both in terms of capital punishment as well as in the prosecution of war. The sixth commandment also holds us responsible for being responsible. If you own an ox, and your ox habitually gores your neighbor, and if it habitually gores the neighbor so that the neighbor is killed, guess what the Bible calls you? As the owner of the ox, you are a rotzak. You are a murderer. Our word, rotzak. It holds you responsible for being responsible. Negligence is not allowed by the Mosaic law. So, well, I don't own an ox. Well, what are the modern applications of this? I think drunk driving is a good application of this. Drunk driving accidents kill 60,000 people a year. Finally, I'll just mention that there are issues that are being debated today that go straight to the heart of the sixth commandment. Debates over abortion, euthanasia, certain forms of stem cell research, and doctor-assisted suicide, I believe all relate directly to the sixth commandment. And as Christians, we should be actively involved in these debates because they trend away from the revealed word of God on these matters. Why is murder a sin? Well, because you're killing someone who bears the image of God, but you're also usurping something that is set aside for God, and that is His sovereignty over life and death. To sum up this commandment, the commandment, thou shalt not kill, is not a universal commandment not to kill, because there are certain situations where killing is not excluded. So the focus being on the innocents, not to kill innocent people. And personally, I'm not going to kill someone because they're stealing my television set. That's my personal decision. I would only see lethal force being an option if my wife were in the line of fire, so to speak. Not understanding this commandment, I think, causes a great deal of difficulty, particularly for our military. I don't know if all of you will agree with everything I've said today. Believe me, I did a lot of work on this. That's what I think this commandment means. Do we have any questions or comments or disagreement? Yeah, what, he raises the question of the motorcycle. In the article, the incident that particularly stayed with this young man after he came home was they killed two people on a motorcycle who turned out not to have weapons or bombs or anything. Can we conclude from that they were innocent? I don't know. Maybe they were going to pick up a bomb. I don't know. I don't think you can pick and choose when you're in those situations. Tom referred to the conquest where there were some pretty stringent commandments given to Israel regarding how they were to rid the land of Canaanites. Question is, do I have any evidence of referring to the fifth commandment of children ever being stoned? I thought about it a time or two when my kids were teenagers. The thing that interests me about that is to think about it in terms of the parable of the prodigal son in that context. You think about the father who forgives the son. According to the Torah, he could have had him stoned. He chose not to do that. Is there a difference in killing and murder? Yes. Killing would be the most general of all terms that refer to the taking of a life. Murder would refer to taking an innocent life illegally. One of the things that I think drives a lot of people today, and it's certainly evident in this article, is exactly that. It is not so much a look at policy as it is how does it affect me. And that's a direct result of the culture that we live in. I'm not berating anybody. I'm not trying to get you to take a position on the Iraq war or whether this is not a political thing for me at all. It is a matter of saying, here's a young man who went into a situation with a certain set of presuppositions. And my only question is, were those presuppositions biblical or were they generated from someplace else? And I'm certainly not being critical of anybody who found themselves in this situation. That's not my point. Obviously, this guy was in a position of some authority, so he's probably an officer. So he's probably in his early 20s. And these are big issues that you can struggle with your whole life, and we expect kids to have all this worked out, and they don't. What Joe is alluding to is if you accept the premise that the government is delegate of divine authority, in that you see human government as a divine institution. And if God has delegated the sword, if you will, to that government, then you're not in a position of having to make every single decision yourself. But there's always the other side to this equation. What if you had been in the military in Germany in the 30s? Where's the line in the sand? I can't resolve all of these issues. I debated about whether to even read this article, but I wanted to show you how not understanding the sixth commandment plays itself out in the world and creates these moral dilemmas for people. He said in there, I didn't come home the same good person that I thought I was. But there's an even more difficult question, and that is their guilt to be forgiven. It's a philosophical question and a theological question. But that's even a more difficult question. Anything else on this? You all still going to come back next week? I don't usually like to delve as much on current events. I know there are classes that sort of build their premises around what's going on in the world. But really what we study in theology should have an impact on the way we behave in the world, the way we understand the world. And having the worldview that this, I'm sure, fine young man has, I don't think served him well. In the situation in which he found himself. But my intent is not in any way to be critical of him at all. Anything else this morning? I think we've just about worn ourselves out. We live in a world of inconsistencies. Let's pray.